Rabbi gave us some other details of a tricky situation. And Rabbi told yesterday, Rabbi Al-Levi has a pussy. So if you take a look at page 4 of the handout, there's a 4 on the top. He says, considering he's finishing up with what we spoke about yesterday, on the top right half, he says, Me'ata, from here on in, me don't be done. In our issue, which we talked about yesterday, Mevur Kolosh Hashela, it says in the language of the question, so he's cast boost. That correspondence between a student, a female student in your institution, between Bachur and a male outside the institution, Allah is likely Lahavi to bring about this. So Oskinuchios, educational results, Shuyosi Osea, which are very negative. Okay, which Adovan means to say, that perhaps that student Allah is likely to face with their Torah to leave the way of Torah Lepia, according to which he mischanefes b'chosat. She is educated in the institution. And perhaps you can say, therefore, the locus zarach in Gershom, because they were sought to go there. The Ben Gershom did not make his decrees in such situations. Shalom yechkan makom avirah chamur, because here there is a potentially severe sin. And at the very least, it certainly pushes off one mitzvah. What the mitzvah is pushing off? The he, which is chinucho, the education of this young girl, the derech Hashem, in the way of God. So you have shalafi zeh, and it's possible, according to this, to allow the opening of the letters. Today, la'amod al tiva is kadmus, in order to ascertain the nature of the correspondence, Lassir Mikshol to remove the stumbling block, as the question was posed. However, he said, Elosh, in Kvari Ganali Beikach, if we already reached this stage, Adito said, Rabbi Levi suggests it's better, instead of opening our letters, forbid us to have a correspondence with a boy. What's the problem? She'eim Safay, she'eishi tov gam yis chabrus v'yidizuz. Because any correspondence has obviously some tinge of connection and friendship. In Yeshua Shobi's Kasus, and if there's a stumbling block in correspondence, Koshken Kavachom, and it's certainly so, Yeshua Shobi Chamur Habeyos, there's a much greater stumbling block, the Etzem Hayedidus, in the very fact of the friendship of Yitzchabut and the connection. At Kilonis Ba'er, the Gupta Shayla, even though it wasn't clarified in the question, Mahusa Bakur, the nature of this boy, Yuman, Mishol, or what the stumbling block is, but we assume that there is one anytime a boy and girl get together. Mashiach Bedat Hanhoa Samasad, La'asol Sakhet Tichosam Akhtavim, and anyway, that which the administration of the school is going to do after they open letters, Tashimiyat, let them do it immediately. Right? Because what are they going to do after they open the letters? They're going to forbid us to have a correspondence with the boy. So, instead of, just cut to the chase, forbid us to have the correspondence immediately. We won't give us up without reading the opening the letters. It says, so actually, it's Lucifer to forbid the actual correspondence. Never in any event, Nira, it seems, she is so up there as a necessity, a kind of to have a fundamental check, Imach Kanichol, with the students, Ulavina Yitain, but understand carefully, as Mahusak Shreem Shalim Babachor said, the nature of her connection with this boy, the Raka Achrei, and only afterwards, we show at one assuming if the matter will remain unclear or literally closed. If sure, yes, then at that point it will be possible, we shall make better psychos and mixovim, that to use the permissibility to open the letter. Elisha, you don't need motif tonight or more. I want to add a clear cut condition. Says on mixovim, these letters be crossed, ask the Raka Machanech, Shalom, the Rai. These letters only read by her teacher. So Chidiya Brura, with a clear knowledge or a clear recollection, that anything which was revealed to him in reading the letters, is a secret. She also got a social with them that he or she cannot reveal to anybody else in turn. The mouth, this is a famous saying thing for the Gemara, the heart should not reveal to the mouth what's going on inside. All of this is not permitted, except to prevent negative results. And to educate a Jewish girl, the derech haTorah v'haMitzvah, in the way of Torah and Mitzvah. So therefore what he says is, of course, as we just read, is that in this case, you can actually permit the opening of the letter, but is preferable to try and avoid it. He wants to avoid it by A, suggesting that they talk to the girl ahead of time and try and ascertain what's going on without opening the letters. B, if that doesn't work, then why don't you just forbid the correspondence altogether, because anyway, that's likely what you're going to do. And C, if that doesn't work, then one person can open the letters and ascertain what's in them, but is not permitted to go and transmit or broadcast those contents to anybody else. He or she who opens the letter will be the one to then decide what to do with the contents. So Rabbi Halevi, even though he's willing to get around the Cheder Avinu Gesher for the, so to speak, this mitzvah to prevent an avera, for the part of the command to prevent the transgression, nevertheless, he was very loath to do more than the very minimal, to allow more than the very minimum. Okay, so that's a very interesting point which he makes here, which is a very, very prevalent question. This actually occurs many times, not in school, but as we mentioned, in a home, right? If your son or daughter or other relative is having a correspondence with somebody, and you suspect that the correspondence is not the type of correspondence you would like to them to have, so then, under those circumstances, are you allowed to go and open the letters and see what's going on? So the same hierarchy of suggestions would apply. It's best to have a fundamental talk and see what's going on. If that it fails to forbid the correspondence, if that fails, then one person, either parents, I guess, can reopen the correspondence, see what's going on, maybe even both parents, but should not reveal further what the nature of the correspondence was. This is something which actually has pretty practical applications. Now, the same thing would probably be true, as we said earlier, about email. If you have a case where somebody is sending email to somebody else and you don't know exactly who the other person is in the correspondence, then you have the same parameters, because theoretically, the email has no different halacha than a regular letter, because a regular letter is, you know, transmitting information from A to B, and so the same thing should apply to transmitting information from A to B, whether by a telephone call, you know, eavesdropping on a telephone call, or by email, the same idea. If that person's private matters were given a seal of privacy by Rabbeinu Gershom, there should be only limited conditions under which you can break that seal of privacy and interfere with that type of communication. So far, so good? Okay? So now, the next thing it brings up, which I find also fascinating, which is something which actually was relevant to me at one time. He says here on the top right, top left, where it says Kukhet. He says, Kukhet says, Kriyat Mikhtavi Azula Shinimtu B'Gneza. Reading somebody else's letters which you found in the Gneza, we commonly call Gneza today in English, Shemos. Right? Shemos is a place where you put stuff which you wrote, which has sanctity to it, or books, you know, old Spartan, and they usually bury them in the ground. You know, they find somewhere to bury them in order to prevent them being desecrated by just being thrown in the garbage. So let's say you go, and this happens in the famous Gneza in Cairo, where in the mid-19th century, they went and they opened up the Gneza, and they took out lots and lots of manuscripts and stuff from the past, I don't know how many it is, 1,000 years, and lots of them became published afterwards. There they found Rambam's actual handwriting, all sorts of other stuff which they found in this Gemiza. So the question is, you know, maybe the Rambam wrote a letter. He wrote, you know, maybe it was a personal letter. Maybe he never intended for you to read his letter, right? I once heard that at one point in Jewish history, they published the letters of the Chidah. Chidah was a famous rabbi in the 18th century. He used to go from place to place raising money for the Jewish community in Chevron. There was a tremendous time. Chacham, a great scholar, and he was sent by the Christian and Chevron all around the world to collect money from, you know, different communities. And he wrote down his travels in a book called Magal Tov, and he also wrote down lots of stuff which he saw in different libraries across the world. He writes, when he came to my ancestral hometown, which is the town of Bechhofen in Germany, that the people in the town were a bunch of cheapskates, and they gave him very little money, and they didn't even give him proper transportation to the next town. That is my august heritage. So my family was living in the town for the last 500 years, so obviously one of the people there at the time was one of my ancestors. So in any event, so much for my pedigree. But in any event, so they... So the, yeah?
Just, so what, what,
Wait, let me answer this one, actually. So the Chidah, actually, at one point they published the Chidah's love letters to his wife. And the guy wrote lots of letters around the way from, you know, wherever he was to his wife. It was a very touching thing. But they weren't meant to be published. Mm-hmm. The Chidah meant for them to be published more than his wife probably needs for them to be published. So therefore, that becomes a very big question, which we're going to deal with now. What happens to letters posthumously? Can you publish some of his letters after his death without his permission? You know, he didn't leave a will or any directive saying that his letters should be published. Yeah?
Question. One of my favorite collections of writing, for example, is the letters of Vincent Van Gogh with his brother Theo.
Mm-hmm.
And when I read them, I feel like I'm violating, you know, that this is stuff that maybe he didn't want anyone to know yet. Millions of people have read this collection of letters. I know some things like the Diary of Anne Frank, the letters and diary of Eddie Falaise, another of us victims. And I wonder if, or, you know, the collected letters of George Bernard Shaw or whoever it is, are these things permissible?
Probably not. So let's see what he writes here. Okay, so he said, Mistaber, very short tshuva, very short response here. Mistaber, it makes sense to say, so some bachurim that boys, so some mikhtavim the gneza, who put their letters in this, you know, shemus in the gneza, kavana some their intent who, he, their intent is, she'ein yodayim machmushno some, that nobody's hands start, you know, going around there to see what's going on. L'chein yesh li manami kriyasa, therefore I should refrain from reading them. This is a good thing anyway, even if they didn't have such a an inclination, the boys left there. Even we assume that there was a question about the matter, and our premise is not correct. It's a good thing to refrain from them anyway. A person must restrain the desire of curiosity, which he has within him. That's what I'm saying. But even if these people actually wouldn't care, it's a good thing for your own personal character traits not to be so curious. Okay?
So
don't overcome your curiosity. What?
So we shouldn't be reading our scrolls Rambam's letter to his son?
Well, I think that was made to be publicized, that one.
Was it?
Yeah, I think it was like an open letter type thing. Oh. And you're right, this is a big problem. Well, I have to tell you, this is a problem which is relevant to me in a couple of ways. First of all, several years ago, I published my grandfather's correspondence with, my grandfather was a rabbi in Switzerland, and my maternal grandfather, and I published his correspondence with his friends, his fellow alumni of the Tel Yeshiva in Lithuania. So, in fact, you know, it would seem, according to what Rabbi Halevi is saying, similar to what you're saying, that perhaps I should not have done this, and perhaps I should have done this. I'll give you justification and sort of rationalization, I should say, in a minute. And another case which I was involved, there was my friend Mark Shapiro, the fellow who we spoke about yesterday, the one, or 2 days ago, the heretic, right? Mm-hmm. So one of his more infamous moves was, it was not his fault, he's entitled to what he wants, but yeah, it was the editor's poor discretion, is that he published the personal letters of Rabbi Chiya Yaakov Weinberg, who was a very great scholar called the Sri Deish, to a Professor Atlas, who was a childhood friend of his, who was a professor in HUC, the Reform Seminary in Cincinnati. And these letters had all sorts of private stuff and nasty comments, for example, which the Sri Deish made about his fellow, quote-unquote, Gedolei Torah, his fellow Torah great, and all sorts of comments about the negative trends in the Jewish people and all that kind of stuff. And all this was published in the Torah Mana Journal, I forget which volume, several years ago, and I went ballistic at the time, and I actually called the editor. It's really, again, the author is entitled to really advocate whatever he wants. It's the editor's discretion. And I called the editor, and I, so to speak, abused him. Mm-hmm. And I sent him this class, which I had, on opening other people's mail, and I actually merited a footnote in the editor's response, as a response to all the, because I was the only complaint, all the complaints which were raised against, which were leveled against him, I was not satisfied with his response. In his response, he digressed, and what's the word, he hemmed and hawed, and it wasn't clear across Yeah.
So in this rabbi's letters that were published, he himself was committing Lashon Hara, and then to distribute the letter was also Lashon Hara.
Well, yeah, it could. I mean, it could be construed as Lashon Hara, but you know, there are certain things you have to have a you know, a more understanding the perspective of the Swedish. Swedish had been suffered terribly in the Holocaust. He had no immediate family. He had no. He divorced his wife at a very young age, and when they got divorced, and it was thought it was, and he had no kids. And his entire, all of his, many of his students had been killed in the war because he was the Rosh Yeshiva in Berlin of the Hildesheim Seminary. So, you know, something like that, you know, after the war, obviously he was, emotionally, he did great work after the war, but obviously emotionally he was distressed. He had to have some sort of an outlet. So instead of going to a psychologist, and he went to a psychologist too, I don't know, but instead of going to a psychologist, so from a little room in Montreux, Switzerland, he wrote this letter, these letters to his childhood friend. And I don't know exactly how much, whether that constitutes Lashon Hara in the stricter sense, because he's not saying to somebody who's really involved with these people, but even if it does, right, let's assume that constitutes Lashon Hara, yes, it would constitute then greater Lashon Hara for these letters to be publicized. Now, let's talk about the letters for a minute. Yeah.
Another question, could we also, before when we were talking about the decrees for polygamy and stuff, you said that there's a view that they're not binding if they conflict with the mitzvah. So there's a mitzvah to spread and learn Torah. So, for instance, like, let's say if Rambam's letter, for instance, would have been private,
mm-hmm.
it still gives very good Torah lessons in it, and mm-hmm. therefore it would be a mitzvah to spread Torah, and if you found this letter, it would be a mitzvah to spread this Torah knowledge around. So would that be able to supersede the rights of spreading and learning Torah, would that be able to supersede the decree of the Bnei Gershom, like in the other cases?
That's an interesting question. And I'll tell you what the other side is. In other words, what Ron is saying is that, well, if a letter contains Torah, so maybe the mitzvah to disseminate that Torah overcomes any personal objection which the individual wrote the letter might have had. But I'm not so sure that's true. Because I heard years ago, I never bothered to try and verify this, it wasn't important to me at the time, that the Chazon Ish, the great scholar of the mid-20th century, left writings, notebooks, on which he wrote that Shelo B'Yun Maspik, he wrote on the cover of the notebook, it was not done with sufficient analysis or sufficient thought, what I wrote here, Lo Lipus, should not be published, right? So these were left after he died. So the question is what to do with them.
Hmm.
So a publisher decided he's going to publish them, and he's going to write on the top of every page, Shalom B'Yom Matzik, Lo Lipus. It wasn't with enough analysis, it's not to be printed. So, and the way I heard the story, which I don't know if it's true or not, that this the publisher died died early as a result of this incident. I don't know how we can know that, and I don't know apocryphal additions to the story. So, be that as it may, in fact, sometimes a person writes Torah and it's not done with full consideration or analysis, and therefore you might, in fact, not want to release despite the fact that it is ostensibly, you know, Torah involved in the midst of learning Torah. And you know, it would seem that he has a certain amount of jurisdiction over that to prevent that being published. Now, there are a few issues here, okay, a few issues we have to discuss. First of all, after a person's death, does the person own anything? So can I say, you know, here are my letters.
Yes.
What?
He owns his memory.
After he's dead?
The memory of Hebrew Allah.
He owns his memory?
Yes.
It still exists in heaven.
The memory is the only thing you
I'm
here.
If you leave the Yeshiva and you have memories of me, I own those memories?
No, but you own them.
How do I own them?
Because they are yours.
They're yours.
Yeah, but the memory that people have of a person when he dies.
They belong to people who have the memories.
I think it belongs to the person who dies.
Why would you say that?
But you cannot change them. I don't know. What do you say?
I'll tell you, like every good thing in Judaism, it's a matter of dispute. So I'll tell you that the issue relates to the issue of autopsies. By autopsies, we have a question, of course, when and where autopsies are permitted, under what circumstances autopsies are permitted in Jewish law. And that also goes back to a Gemara Bavatra. So, in a nutshell, there is the tshuva of the Binyan Tzion. The Binyan Tzion was a great rabbi in Germany in the mid-19th century, and he wrote a responsum in saying that it is forbidden to conduct an autopsy on a person after his death, because that's theft, because you're stealing his body from him. Of course, that comes out to a stringency, but it also comes out to a potential leniency. Because other post-him, other halachic authorities tell a person doesn't own his body after his death. And nevertheless, you know, that's created because it is, you know, a holy Jewish body, so to speak. So according to Aruch HaNer, though, according to Bina Tzim, also known as Aruch HaNer, according to Aruch HaNer, so if theoretically, if it's a matter of theft, then a person could will his own body to science, right? Because then he says, okay, it's not theft in my case. I'm willing to have my body undergo an autopsy. So the stringency and leniency. The stringency is you can't go and do without his permission, even if you have a really good reason to do an autopsy, right? You want to clarify whether a murder occurred, you want to see what kind of disease he died of, because you want to learn because you have an epidemic, whatever the case may be, you can't do it because you can't steal from this individual. You're not to steal without his permission. Now you're not to steal from a person, strictly speaking, in order to save a life. So therefore, unless you get without permission, you wouldn't be able to do it, even for a good cause. On the other hand, if he gave permission, then he would be allowed to do it because, again, the Aruch HaNer is basically his entire understanding of the prohibition of autopsy on the concept of ownership after death. So then, if that's the case, if it has to do with ownership after death, I mean, if ownership is if there's a machlekes, a dispute, there's a way there's ownership after death, the same thing applies here by letters, assuming that the prohibition here is a form of theft. If Rabbeinu Gershom is predicated on the concept of theft, right, which is one of the undermining rationale itself, Rabbeinu Gershom's decree, so then, if you hold, like the BNC on the Aruch HaNer, that even after death, the person has ownership, if you don't have a person's permission, you can't go and publish his letters. Because he still retains that intellectual ownership, which he had over during his lifetime, kind of like you said. But if a person cannot own anything after death, his legal status has ceased to exist, so then, technically speaking, from that perspective, you could then publish his letters. You know, he's dead, heck with him, right? I have his letters here, he doesn't own them. Now they're open season on the letters, right? But, on the other hand, it could well be that Kren Rabbeinu Gershom is based on one of the other issues which are involved, such as, you know, you shouldn't do something to somebody else, which is you wouldn't want them for yourself, or something along the lines of Lashon Hara, and then it may well apply after death. Right, and the person might well be able to apply it, even if theft is not relevant, but perhaps Lashon Hara and the other prohibitions of gossiping are. On the other end of that, it's not so simple that there's a prohibition of Lashon Hara on somebody after he's dead. If a person speaks Lashon Hara about a living person, so it's forbidden because there can be negative ramifications. But if a person speaks Lashon Hara about a dead person, he's dead. What difference is it going to make to him at this point?
There's a lot of negative ramifications.
What?
There's a lot of negative ramifications.
What are negative ramifications?
For instance, like, let's say there's this great rabbi, and he dies, and everyone's learning from him, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and they think, you know, all his teaching is great. And then he had some personal things, you know, in his past, some letters when he was 13 or something that, you know, vulgar, whatever it is, right? Or some Torah that he wrote when he was 12 that is just total nonsense. And then they're published, and then everyone sees you and say, he said that, and then they say, oh, well, he's not so great, and their whole idea of him gets diminished way down, and then they don't necessarily think he's so great, and they won't learn from his teachings.
Right, but that's true. But Lashon Hara, strictly speaking, is causing a
person.
So causing damage to a living person, not causing damage to the reputation of a person who's dead. But
causing damage to Torah knowledge.
To Torah knowledge, right, damaging perhaps Torah in that sense, but not the person. But there is, in fact, there's a cheren, similar to cheren Rabbeinu Gershom, which was enacted, we don't know exactly by whom, when, but it was enacted not to speak Lashon Hara even about dead people. So even though it's not strictly speaking the same prohibition we have in the Torah as Lashon Hara, in the classic sense, it still is prohibited. Now, to come back to our issue here, the letters of the Swedish. Letters of the Swedish were not left by the Swedish. He wrote the letters to Cincinnati. The letters were in Cincinnati. The letters in Cincinnati were left after Professor Adler died in the possession of his widow. his widow, I guess he didn't have any kids, or if he had kids, so it wasn't relevant to him. His widow gave the letters as a gift to the library of the Jewish Theological Seminary. I don't know, since her husband was a professor at HUC, why she gave them as a gift to JTS, but be that as it may, that is what she did. And in JTS, they were kept in a special restricted section. Somehow Mark Shapiro got access to the special restricted section and then copied the letters and published them. So, in my opinion, in this case, it is most certainly clear-cut that there should be no reason to allow the publication of these letters. Because, A, the Swedish Age didn't leave the letters himself. Professor Atlas, the recipient, left the letters. B, they were not left in a way which indicated they should be published. On the contrary, they were put in a restricted access section in some library, right? So therefore, it would seem that they could not be published and were not meant to be published. And therefore, Chen Rabbeinu Gershom could well apply if the older steps after death, it applies, and if the older Lashon Hara after death, then applies as well, and it was not proper, in my opinion, to print those letters. On the other hand, like a couple you mentioned before, it seems that when an individual leaves letters in his home, when his family has access to them, correspondence, and they are not letters of a negative sort, but rather of either historical or of Jewish Torah or Musar interest, then, this is my rationale for what I do, remember, I'm rationalizing, I may be wrong, but the rationalization is that under those circumstances, it has generally been assumed throughout Jewish history that letters are fair game, meaning that a person's correspondence after his death can be published, because that's the way it's always been. Being in publishing the Torah and the letters, as long as they're not personal, you know, intimate letters, the of great giants in Torah after their death, including, for example, Chazanish's letters. They published, you know, some names were removed to protect the guilty, but or the innocent, case may be. But in any event, they were published after Chazanish's death, and so too with many other Torah giants throughout the ages. So I would say that there's that distinction depending on the nature of the letter and the place where the letter was in terms of access. And that's why we have all this precedent of the publication of many people's letters after their death. Also, it's not 100% clear whether perhaps permission can be granted or can't be granted. That's something which is something that has to be clarified. It's not clear to me if that works. I mean, let's say you got permission, as I did, from my grandmother to publish my grandfather's correspondence. Well, that's fine and dandy, but it doesn't necessarily work. Because remember, in every correspondence, there are two parties involved, right? So therefore, yes, maybe I can get her permission to publish her husband's correspondence, but how could I publish the correspondence of the other people to her husband? That's something which, you know, I took my chances and I did anyway. Simply because at that point, Mark Shapiro, in an email which he sent out to a list in which I participate, said that, you know, based on the tumult which occurred as a result of this publication, which again, it's not his fault directly, it's really the fault of the editor, said that perhaps it is indeed not possible to be a truly academic historian if you are an Orthodox Jew. So you can be an academic historian concerning, you know, the culture of Sumeria in the early first century, or the Napoleonic Wars in the 19th century. But to be a historian of Jewish history in any century may well be something which a Jew cannot be objective about, because objectivity very often entails publicizing things which are negative, and also pursuing and perhaps even publishing things which are meant to remain private. A historian has no qualm publishing the negative letters about which an individual issued. That's part of the historical record, right? It's a very, very important part of the historical record. But we have other issues which are riding on this, including perhaps Chaim Rabbeinu Gershom. So therefore, it may well be that it is not possible for a truly observant individual to be a truly objective academic historian about matters which have to do with Judaism, which is a problem. It's a problem. That's the way it is. But it's a problem. In fact, there is an approach, which I don't subscribe to, but the approach which Rabbi Schechter, who's the editor of the Torah Mada Journal, he brought down in his response, you know, the one in which he quoted me in a footnote, which I think had no place there and was completely irrelevant, but he just wanted to dilute his guilt, Michael. But he brought down, there is an opinion, there is a famous quote from Rabbi Shimon Schwab. Shimon Schwab was the leader of the German Jewish community in the United States until his demise about 10 years ago. And he writes one place, he says, listen, he writes blatantly, he says, we don't have to tell the whole truth about our ancestors. It's only about the German Jewish community before the war in Germany. That's what good it serve? We all know that there are problems in the community. Why should we go about and publicizing them? What we need to learn from previous generations is what will inspire us in order that we should be able to emulate their good traits and be able to learn from the stuff which they did, how to further ourselves in our divine service. So his argument was that it is good and proper and right to cover up as much as possible. Because in covering up, you actually are able to diminish the negative and accent the positive. Now, I don't subscribe to that completely because I think that there are certain flaws which are problems in Jewish history which are important to know for several reasons. A, so you don't think everybody was perfect, and since you're imperfect, then you're not going to make it to that level. B, because there are many issues in Judaism today which can only be understood if you understand the politics which took place, you know, a century or two centuries ago. So therefore, there are cases in which it's worthwhile knowing what went on without necessarily, you know, just accenting the positive. But there is such an opinion about Jewish history that we really should just focus on the positive and ignore the negative.
Let's say, you know, the Soviets would have the same position on reviewing 20th century Soviet history, and in the Roman Catholic Church, if they didn't have to rely on other sources, could whitewash the current scandal with heresy. And
haven't they tried to do that?
They try, but obviously the truth has come out. And the world is better for having the truth come out.
That's what you say. I don't disagree with you.
Right.
But that's what you say. But I'm not so sure that Cardinal Egan agrees with you.
Right. The church prefers sweeping under the table.
Right, and they hold it's better to sweep
right.
under the table.
And so just because, you know, I think the truth trumps starts stealing.
It's a very big statement.
It is, I guess.
I wouldn't make it so quick. Batter
someone over the head with the truth,
and
nevertheless, you need a holistic view of the world or your section of the world, seeing the good and the bad, in order to learn and to you yourself become a better person.
I don't necessarily disagree with you. I'm not asking. I might agree with you, but I'm asking you to see the other perspective. You understand the other perspective.
Yes.
The flip side of the perspective is, listen, ultimately, what's history worth? It's worth us learning from history how to lead our lives. So therefore, we should focus on what is going to teach us how to lead our lives and not what's going to detract from our capacity to live and mother.
Once you start accentuating only the positive, it almost gives you license to create untrue stories that accentuate the positive.
It's called historical fiction. It happens all the time.
I'm not just saying historical fiction which revolved around the certain era, but I'm saying, you know, people did miracles or people did this, that, and another thing that didn't happen.
The Golem.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, the Golem was written by somebody who was a known forger because he wanted to make money.
Right.
That's a different thing.
But you'll hear rabbis mentioning that.
He had ulterior motives. What?
You'll hear rabbis mentioning that.
Like, right.
He was
a good forger.
Yeah.
In American history curriculums, you know, there's all sorts of people who say, well, we want to wipe out these legends of George Washington with the cherry tree. It simply didn't happen. You know, we want to emphasize that Jefferson was a slaveholder. And there's a lot of people saying, no, look, these are the forefathers of our country, and we want to... there are lessons that we can learn, and they were essentially noblemen, and we want to emphasize the nobility and downplay the shady side.
Because, I mean, slavery is illegal now, so what are you going to learn by learning that Jefferson was a slave owner? I mean, all it's going to do is make contempt for the leaders of the founders of the country. It's not going to teach you
right.
If you already know slavery is wrong.
That's true, and you can't really understand the context of the time or of his writings or of anything without...
That's true, but it's hard. It's also hard in context to understand something unless you're a sophisticated, intelligent individual. It's also hard to understand something which was written 80 years ago in the context of the time of which it was written. In other words, today there was once where I, what I do when I write an article and I don't want to put something in which I feel not worth quoting, so I put in, of course, in three dots. Listeners, unless somebody go look it up. So that's their issue. So, for example, there is a quote from one of my heroes, from Barbara Mary Kaplan. There's a long article on Herzl, essay on Herzl, very interesting essay on Herzl. And the way he ends the essay is, it says, and the more I became connected to God, the more I became connected to Zionism. Very, very powerful statement to make, and today, most people in the right-wing Orthodox camp would not be happy with such a statement. So this statement, however, was made in 1918, right? So it was made a long time ago in a different context. So unless you have a very sophisticated audience, they're not going to be able to stomach that statement because they think in the terms of the late 20th or early 21st century about statements which were made back in the early 20th century. A historian or somebody who's more sophisticated is able to contextualize that. But what's more true, so to speak, in that case? To quote the line without comment and not contextualize it, or to just delete the line and let somebody who wants to go back to the source go and find it? What's actually more true in that situation?
That's a good question.
Right. I don't have the answer. I tell you what I do.
All right. On the other hand, you can't really pander to the lowest common denominator of understanding. You know, there has to
be... It depends who you're writing for. If you're writing for a popular audience.
For children?
No, a popular audience.
No, I'm saying if we go back to the example of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, for children, you can build the apple tree and what have you, but sometimes people at college level are adults. You can give a whole video.
You're getting far more too much credence to adults.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In high school, they use that just to bash the country, basically. It's a liberal campus, and so they use all the Jefferson Oath plays. This person did this.
Right.
I took a class on Revolutionary America.
I guess they actually emphasize the negative.
Mm-hmm. Much more so.
When you have the negative, it means the negative and the positive together simultaneously.
Which they don't do.
Well, it's very hard to overcome. It's very hard to overcome the prejudices of high school textbooks. High school textbooks cause lifelong damage to the people who use them in high school. Right. But also, you have to realize that you have to remember P.T. Barnum's famous quote, never underestimate the stupidity of the American people. So in other words, it's not 100% true. I know that the British are culturally and maybe they're different, but you know, the Americans, they're pretty stupid, relatively speaking. So therefore, I would not give so much credence to the adult population of the United States and assume that they are sophisticated enough to discern nuances.
Even the so-called intellectual elite, the academics, are also often lopsided, one-sided, and
prejudiced.
So you can't even count on them.
Right. So it's a big problem.
So should we write anything?
So that was Mark Shapiro's, you know, quandary at the time. That was what he was saying. Maybe, in fact, it's impossible to be a truly, you know, objective Jewish historian. Maybe there's some real big problem with that, and maybe there is. I don't have the answer. Just pointing out that there's a major problem. All right, we'll have to stop here for today. We'll finish up with this topic tomorrow. Anybody want to suggest a new topic on Thursday?